At the end of last week, I introduced to you the beautiful first-class constraints of general relativity. And let me just write them down, not in their full glory. So as we saw, they are first-class, indeed. Per space-time point is understood. So I called them the momentum constraints. So all of them are called curly H. So there are three of those. I is just a spatial index. And to be kind of somewhat more explicit than I was, I could write them in the following way, which means, well, they're simultaneously, of course, functionals of these fields, but they also depend, well, they depend on a space-time point, x. And then we had the Hamiltonian constraint. So this has to vanish on physical states. It's of an analogous functional form, also depending on the three metrics and their canonically conjugate momenta. OK, and we already saw that the degree of freedom counting worked similar to what it did in the perturbative theory, but it also accords with the presence of symmetries. So of course, we have the diffeomorphism symmetries, which ultimately give rise, lie at the at the origin of the existence of these first-class constraints. And there, of course, I have four per space-time point corresponding to the kind of four directions in which I can kind of move independently when I make kind of an infinitesimal diffeomorphism. And these gauge transformations map metrics on physically equivalent metrics. OK, so that's what is the background of the existence of these constraints. And as we saw, they form a closed Poisson bracket algebra. That means the right-hand side of the Poisson brackets can be expressed as a linear combination of the constraints. And this object is called the Dirac algebra. And I also explained that this was not the same as the Lie algebra of four-dimensional diffeomorphisms, because everything now depends implicitly on this 3 plus 1 split and this kind of reference slicing I've introduced. So you should more think like of this as a kind of a projection perpendicular to and along this chosen time direction. So these preserve their character, these momentum constraints, as generators of infinitesimal diffeomorphisms. But kind of the interpretation of this Hamiltonian constraint is kind of much less clear. OK, so after talking about this constraint structure for GR, I started to talk generally about some issues one has to address when one quantizes a system with constraints or gauge symmetries, as it is the case here. So then some fundamental issues arise. And well, one way of phrasing it, I drew kind of a little diagram for you on the board, was to say, well, I have to decide whether I first constrain and then quantize, or the other way around. Of course, all kinds of mixtures where I partially do one and partially do the other also exist. But these are kind of the two extremes. Now, so at what stage this reduction should be performed is one of the questions. So just to advertise some of my own work, to see that actually you can come up with examples where this diagram turns out to be non-commutative, certainly in quantum mechanics. So there's a of non-commutativity of this diagram of constraining versus quantizing I drew for you. So this is actually a piece of work I wrote up for my thesis. But I look at it again, and it's quite nice. And it makes the point quite clearly that I was making here in the lectures. OK, so the two extreme, the two extremes of how to proceed. A is the first constrain in the classical theory, and then quantize. So that's what I, where we stopped our discussion last week. So let me just kind of pick up there a little bit and write some things on the blackboard, which I didn't then. So that's kind of the first constraint, then quantize. So that went kind of in my diagram, you know, first down and then to the right. And then I also said, well, this is generally problematic, because it, what tends to happen is when you do the reduction classically, now we've been talking about phase spaces, but the same would be true for configuration spaces, because of course the same issue arises also in principle when you do a covariant quantization. So it's not specific to this setting, you could say. So what typically happens is that the reduced, classically reduced space is nonlinear. Now, some people ask me after the lecture, what does that mean, nonlinear? So, of course, in mechanics, it means that the, say, the configuration space or the phase space is not an R2n. So I cannot, therefore, parameterize it. That's one of the consequences globally by variables xi, so by a single global charge. And, well, moreover, even if, well, so that, and that presents, of course, some problems in what one means by quantization. So you cannot just say, well, let me perform a standard Schrödinger quantization with canonical commutation relations, because it will not usually be applicable, or only be applicable in a patch, but this doesn't help you. I mean, the quantum theory really sees all of the configuration, or all of the phase space. So then unless, say, it turns out that your, say, your curved reduced configuration space or phase space is acted on in a nice way, say by some group. So imagine it was, say, the surface of an N-sphere or so. Then you still have nice group actions, which to some extent you can then use in the quantization. So if there is a specific group that acts nicely and freely on your reduced configuration space, then often that will make a prominent appearance in an algebra of functions you can quantize on it. But in, if there is no such symmetry, natural, if you don't have such a highly symmetric reduced configuration space, then in general you're lost. So what you have to do in principle, if you go this way, is you then have to look classically for a complete set of observables, so things that live on this quotient space, a physical space. And then quantize those, or some algebraic structure, say their Poisson bracket structure algebra. And, well, first of all, usually that is not known, such a structure, well, or not known in very explicit terms. And then you just don't know how to quantize it. And what also comes into play specifically in quantum field theory, and which you might say is the reason why we carry along a redundancy in our variables in the first place, is that reducing is often in conflict, say, with imposing Lorentz covariance, right, or locality. So why do we work with gauge potentials in electromagnetism? Well, to be able to write down a Lorentz invariant local Lagrange function. If I reduce things just to the physical degrees of freedom, then I cannot maintain these two things simultaneously. So there's often, well, a good reason for why one works with these redundant sets of variables. But of course, in the end, one needs to get rid of them in some consistent way. So so this was just some edit remarks to this way of doing things. So I was just, let me just write down. So this tends to be problematic. It doesn't have to be, but it often happens. Whenever, so curly C is configuration space, or curly S, of course, was I used for as a symbol for phase space. So the physical configuration or phase spaces and of phase spaces are nonlinear. So what does nonlinearity mean in the field theory? Well, it's not the case that I can assume that my field variables, or if I talk about a tensorial quantity, the individual components take their values on the entire real axis, if it's a real field, or on the complex numbers. So there are some kind of restrictions imposed on me. So that makes this thing nonlinear. Okay, so usually one cannot really carry through that program, and this is why one most often resorts to the other way of doing things. So that a first quantizing and then constraining. And that raises the issue of how you're going to perform the reduction in the quantum theory. And a popular way of doing it goes by the name of Dirac quantization. This consists of a number of steps. So firstly, you just work with the extended system, and you treat it as if it was the real physical system. So you just go ahead and kind of quantize it. I call this theory redundant because it contains both physical and gauge degrees of freedom still. Theory on some Hilbert space. That's, of course, what we mean by quantizing. You choose a Hilbert space. You choose operator representations of some class of functions. This I call. So I have now various versions of curly H's floating around. This is my symbol for Hilbert space. And I call this the auxiliary Hilbert space. And so let QI collectively kind of indicate the configuration variables of my unreduced theory. Now, step number two is kind of the important one. Now, how are we constraining on this Hilbert space? Well, we impose a condition on the vectors that those have to satisfy in order for me to think of them as physical state vectors, so as being relevant for the reduced quantum theory. So, and the way this is implemented is by turning the first class constraints. So that's all I'm talking about here in terms of constraints, first class constraints. If I implement those on states of the quantum theory, and I call a general state psi of the QI a member of my physical Hilbert space H phys, if, now this is just a quantized version of my classical first class constraints, if these applied on the states QI, if they vanish, where now A runs through all labels of my set of constraints. So the way this is also always, often phrased, it says, well, all the quantum constraints annihilate physical wave functions. Now, let us have a brief look of why this makes sense in a simple situation like we've looked at in some of the examples we've explicitly calculated. So let me again look at this very simple example. where I do quantum mechanics on R3. And I have a single first class constraint, which consists in the vanishing of the momentum in the three direction. Okay. So my phase space here is an R6. And my coordinates are Q1, Q2, Q3, P1, P2, P3. And of course, wave functions, I mean, as usual, they depend on just half of the phase space function. And the usual choice is to let them depend on the coordinates here. So let us make this choice also. So our auxiliary Hilbert space is now simply given by square integrable wave functions of these three configuration spaces. They are also kind of standard Schrödinger quantization. So my wave functions are just depend on these three Q arguments. Now, what is the Dirac prescription here to be implemented in the quantum theory? Well, it obviously is phi hat psi. Now, that was, of course, the same as P3 hat applied on psi. And now, in standard Schrödinger quantization, this is a minus I h bar d by d Q3 of psi. And my condition is that this should vanish. And of course, what that means is that any physical wave function psi fizz is a function of Q1 and Q2 only. So all of these functions, their square integral, they now span my physical Hilbert space. And this is now given simply by the square integral functions on R2. Now, does this fit kind of with the expectation we had just coming from the classical theory? Yes, it does fit exactly with it. Because let me again draw my little kind of box picture. So let this be S. Let this inside here be my classical constraint surface defined by the vanishing of the momentum P3. And then, of course, as we saw last week, this has, we still have gauge freedom on this constraint surface, where P3 generates gauge orbits in this manner. And of course, the gauge orbits, they go exactly along the flow lines of Q3. Right? So what we're implementing here is to say, aha, well, also our wave functions must be independent of this gauge direction. So here you're really implementing exactly, in this simple example, well, what you saw happen in the classical theory. And it's also fairly obvious, apart from small subtleties, that here actually this process is commutated, at least at the level of just looking at these configuration variables. Of course, I haven't talked about Hamiltonian or anything. I've just made this discussion at the level of the relevant Hilbert spaces. Okay, so in a simple example, it's clearly plausible that this prescription does exactly what I want it to do. Now, one thing one has to pay attention to in this Dirac quantization is that this is consistent. So, of course, classically recall that our constraints satisfied an algebra, Poisson bracket algebra of this kind. Now, this you want to represent faithfully in the quantum theory. Yeah, so, and there is a possible problem of a consistency. So what one has to demand in order for this kind of to be true, to be represented exactly in the quantum theory, one has to demand the following. So it has to intertwine appropriately with this projection condition here, which is kind of the key of the Dirac quantization. And this is that now the quantum commutator of the quantized constraints must be equal to IH bar F hat A, B, C, phi C. Now, why is this in general a non-trivial requirement? Well, first of all, of course, I told you that in general, these Fs, they are not structure constants, in which case these would just be numbers, but they are structure functions. So they depend themselves on the phase space variables. So they will also be quantized as operators on your Hilbert space. And then, in general, unfortunately, it doesn't follow in the quantum theory that on the right-hand side, things will appear in this particular order. Because it might just as well happen kind of that the FABC hats appear to the right of those. So then what you have to do is to commute, well, these past the Fs, if the Fs appear on the right, then you have to commute them past each other. And that will generally generate a term of the form of a higher, of second order in H bar, because you've done one more quantum commutator, some other operator. Let me call it dAB hat. So this is what typically, well, you can pick up upon doing this. Now, why does this present a problem here? Now, I'm told, of course, that individually the constraints have to annihilate my physical wave functions. So they do this. So applying kind of the left and the right hand side simultaneously on a wave function, of course, the left hand side vanishes. This piece vanishes, right, because I have just phi hat C acting on a wave function. But now I have to demand also for consistency that D I V applied on phi physical also vanishes. So that's the consistency one is talking about here. And of course, that is highly problematic because there is no classical analog of this equation here. So what in general what this does, it overconstrains physical wave functions. So it kills degrees of freedom that are physical, that are not gauge, right? And depending on what these DABs are, it might kill actually all of your degrees of freedom. And that's, of course, then there is absolutely no sense to this construction in the quantum theory. Certainly, if this happens, if terms like this appear, then first of all, what you can say is that, well, the algebra is certainly not represented properly in the algebra of gauge transformations is not represented properly. And what you, in the quantum theory, and what you then say is that, well, the gauge invariance is broken at the quantum level. And a term like this, if that appears, is an example of a gauge anomaly. So in cases where it's kind of impossible to arrange the quantization of these constraints appropriately, such that this is true, well, then this method simply doesn't work. It doesn't make sense. Okay, so after this warning, let us turn to have a look at what this construction implies now for general relativity. So formally, what would the individual kind of steps of this quantization program look like? I mean, one of them I erased. So we'd formally start out using the metric variables we've been working with some Hilbert space. I put it in inverted commas because it's not particularly mathematically well defined, of wave functions that depend on your configuration variables. Hij. Oh, that's step number one. Then you really attempt a kind of infinite dimensional analog of what is Schrödinger quantization in finite dimensions by promoting the Poisson brackets of the fundamental canonically conjugate pairs to canonical commutators. So what would these look like? Well, hij hats at point x, pi kl hat at point y, well, at equal time is understood, should their commutator should give a right-hand side, which is just a straightforward kind of quantization of the classical Poisson brackets. So delta ik, delta jl, plus delta il, delta jk, three-dimensional delta function of x and y. So now we've kind of defines this as a habitat and fundamental operators of the extended theory. Now, of course, we have to quantize the constraints. So that's step number three. quantize. So H mu. So the set of these four first class constraints. And demand that physical wave functions lie in the joint kernel of all these constraints. Well, these, of course, are, you know, differential, functional differential operators. And then lastly, in order to identify the reduced quantum theory, we still need a physical Hilbert space, which means in practice that you'll have to find a suitable scalar product on these physical wave functions. So find scalar product on the physical wave functions. And in other words, just to find what the physical Hilbert space is. Now you might ask, well, why? Why is there a problem here? Don't these wave functions just inherit kind of a scalar product structure from the scalar product of the auxiliary Hilbert space? And the answer is, unfortunately, in general, they will not. Because you see, even in this very simple case, although it's fairly transparent that one wants to end up with a reduced Hilbert space, which is just wave functions of, you know, Q1 and Q2, kind of the two physical variables, you see that what lies in the kernel, if you're really starting out with wave functions that are square integral on R3 to start with, so are elements of here, you see that this equation actually has no solutions in that space. Why is that? Because this condition stipulates that psi is constant as a function of Q3. And if it's constant, and if it doesn't happen to be zero to start with, of course, it cannot possibly be a square integrable function. Right? It just has one constant direction. So you see already here in this very simple example, kind of where one still kind of knows where one wants to go, that some issue, some potential problem arises. And of course, the problem is much aggravated in this much more complicated case of a field theory and GR in particular. So let me now highlight a small subset of problems that appears in trying to implement this program now for gravity. So the first issue is, well, with this kind of setup at the level of the extended Hilbert space. Right. So this auxiliary Hilbert space. So one thing, one potential problem with these commutation relations is that they are not compatible with the physical constraints that the determinant of Hij should be larger than zero. Because these are kind of analogs, kind of the Q's and P's in quantum mechanics. And of course, what you know when you quantize Q and P in quantum mechanics, well, you know that the spectrum of both of these consists of the entire real axis. And in a similar manner, you can see that if you have operators that satisfy this algebra, then these momenta will actually generate arbitrary translations on the hijs. And the hijs are, of course, the arguments of your wave functions. And they will, in general, just carry you to some part. So these wave functions, therefore, will, in general, have non-trivial support on hijs, which violate determinant hij larger than zero. So strictly speaking, I mean, these relations are already fishy if you look now at gravity. So relation star, this is what I wanted to call relation star. It's not already at that level, not quite right, so it does not respect hij, sorry, that hij. And I would say that highlights part of a general problem. Of course, the presence of a constraint of this kind means that already at the level of the extended phase space or configuration space, well, you don't have a linear space, right? Because this exactly tells you that you're sitting in a cone. Now, also, unfortunately, what was so nice, you know, about the Schrödinger quantization was that it essentially was unique, and it also gave you a natural Hilbert space where wave functions were square integral with respect to the natural Lebesgue measure of your configuration space variables. Now, unfortunately, this Lebesgue measure simply doesn't exist in infinite dimensions, so there is no such thing. So one is pretending here, one is working here very much in analogy with what one does in finite dimensions, but it's very doubtful. I mean, mathematically, it's pretty ill-defined what one is doing here. So there is no, that is one problem. So there is no what I call a functional Lebesgue measure. So when people write things like curly D H I J, I mean, what on earth is this going to mean? Now, very severely, a problem that appears is that of operator ordering ambiguities when you now try to quantize these constraints. So operator ordering ambiguities. Of course, you have to satisfy, as you have already seen, you have to satisfy kind of consistently the Dirac algebra. Well, that turns out to be difficult. Now, let me just write down what the quantized constraints are if I now adopt this kind of Schrödinger type of hatting my basic phase space variables, then what I get for the constraint, quantum constraint equations is the following. So hi hat psi. Now what I do, I choose a particular factor ordering. This is just an arbitrary choice I'm just making here for the sake of being writing down something concrete, where all the momenta stand to the right of all occurrences of the coordinates hij. Yes. And these just in the usual manner. These are just converted to partial derivatives with respect to hij. So that's my Schrödinger quantization. So, and what you then find here, so if you look back from last week, what was the classical functional form of the constraints? I'm now substituting in hik, the quantization of these basic variables, delta functional derivative with respect to hkj psi equal to 0. So here, if you look back in your notes, that came from an expression which was a pi I, something like ij. Right. So I've pulled down one of the indices with the h. So that's my quantized hij hat, which I'm representing by simple multiplication with hij. And then the pi with the indices upstairs, I represent by this functional differential. So this is one of my, so that's the quantum momentum constraint. And now to the Hamiltonian constraint, h perp hat. So I'm quantizing that in the same manner. Now, it has this kinetic term, quadratic, in the pi's. And of course, for each of those, I pick up now in this quantization a factor of minus I h bar. So I times I gives rise to the minus sign you see here. And then you get an h bar squared. H bar squared. And then this with supermetric, as you've seen last time, curly G, I j k l appears, and a double functional derivative, h I j del h k l. And then we still had a potential term where no momenta appear, but only h. So determinant of h appears. Kappa squared appears. Remember, this was equal to 16 pi g Newton. And the three-dimensional curvature appears. And this applied on a wave function should vanish in Dirac quantization. And well, this beautiful equation has a name, famous name, name of two famous physicists. It's called the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. Or, you see, of course, you know what I should really call this is the momentum constraints, because I have one of those for every space-time point. Right, so remember this. So of course, we are in a field theoretic context. And these I also should maybe call the Wheeler-DeWitt equations. OK, now let us contemplate a little bit what these mean, imply. Now, in a way, these are fairly straightforward, because in the way I've implemented them here, they can be shown to be truly the generator of three-dimensional spatial diffeomorphisms. You know, in very much the same way as my, you know, my P3 hat in this simple quantum mechanical example transported me along lines, well, of orbits in the Q3 direction. So what this equation, this set of equations means is that psi should depend only on diffeomorphism equivalence classes of three matrix Hij. So that's a kind of transparent. So two comments. So H curly H I hat also have three times infinity of those. They generate spatial diffeomorphisms. And requiring Hi hats to be zero on physical wave functions distinguishes wave functions Hij, psi of Hij, which are diffeomorphism invariant functionals of these H's. Functional of Hij. So in other words, you could say psi is a functional on superspace. So at least, I mean, the interpretation of that is fairly straightforward. It doesn't imply that we know of a neat parameterization of superspace, which again would be somehow needed if one was to work explicitly with these things. Well, but these are all kind of minor problems compared with the problems that are presented by this Wheeler-DeWitt equation. First, of course, you see that functionally this is much, much more difficult. And well, one characteristic feature here is that you find this, the double functional derivative at the same point. Remember, of course, they live at a point x, right, these objects. So there is an x here and an x there. So you know, of course, already, this is kind of in even standard quantum field theory the case, if you have such a double functional derivative, it will give rise to divergent terms that are of the form delta of zero. And you need necessarily, in order to make sense of the equation, you need to regularize and potentially renormalize this equation. Now, this regularization and renormalization cannot be seen, cannot be discussed apart from factor ordering issues. Because, you know, here I've just written down a specific way of doing the factor ordering of this kinetic term. But of course, this has H dependence in it, and this has momentum dependence in it. And well, these could appear in all possible orders. So there is just actually is an infinity of possibilities in which I could order these. Yes. And of course, the problem is, so you're faced with a multi-component problem. Right, you have to represent the Dirac algebra kind of faithfully, and at the same time, really what you have to do, you have to do it at a regularized level, because otherwise this type of operator is just completely ill-defined. So that means also that the regularization, of course, should intertwine in a nice way with the invariances of your theory. And there is a problem there. Because, for example, a typical thing you might want to do is kind of to point split the two arguments here. And this is something that's not really compatible with Diffeo invariance. So whichever way you're trying to attack these problems, you're in trouble. You're in deep trouble. So so certainly, let me make the statement, the second, the Wheeler-DeWitt equation must be regularized and possibly renormalized to get rid of infinities And moreover, this cannot be discussed apart from the issue of which factor ordering to choose. And, well, maybe finally, to stop for the day, if you had solved these problems, you would still have no idea how to solve this equation. Okay. It's as simple as that. Okay, so no idea. So it's right at the bottom here. No idea, the said statement, how to solve. Okay, so let's stop here. Let's wrap up this discussion briefly tomorrow. Then I'll explain about a different way of canonical quantizing, starting not from metric, but from connection variables. But where, unfortunately, the bottom line will be that you, in the end, although you see some improvements, you can make some of these structures much better defined mathematically, in the end, you are really faced with crucial problems regarding the Hamiltonian constraint, the constraint algebra. And that's where we stand. Okay, I see.